The journals, they're basically being paid $5,000 per paper to lock publicly generated knowledge behind paywalls. The vast majority of scientists in the world, including in the United States, don't have comprehensive access.
Michael Eisen is an acclaimed biologist and a co-founder of the Public Library of Science, or PLOS, which publishes some of the largest and most prestigious academic journals in the world. These journals stand out for another reason. They're open access, meaning that anyone with an internet connection can read their articles for free. Eisen's goal is to change the way scientific findings are disseminated. Currently, most research papers are locked behind paywalls, and access can run as high as tens or hundreds of dollars per article. PLOS seeks to break up the academic publishing cartel, and it's a leading force in the so-called open science movement, which aims to give the public access to cutting-edge research and democratize scientific progress.
Labs get hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars that come in from the public after they write up what they've discovered. You know, if you're a member of the public and you want to get access to it, you quite often have to pay again to get access to it. So it's a completely ridiculous system when the internet was invented that should have allowed scientists to share their work completely freely with the world.
And so what are the consequences of it being so expensive for the average person to access this research?
They can't get access to it if they need it for their health. They can't get access to it if it's important for their job. You know, if you're a student at Harvard, you can get access to everything. But if you're a student at a community college or a smaller university, or you're in high school, or, you know, you're just curious about something that you read about, you can't get access to the primary literature on that topic. And that's the most visible problem. But an even bigger problem is that it makes science work less effectively. The vast majority of scientists in the world, including in the United States, don't have comprehensive access to the scientific literature. Even though it's all online, it happens all the time that somebody is doing something in their lab and they don't know about something that could make their work better and push it to the next level because they don't have access to the journal in which that work was published. And finally, it's bad for the public because it's just really expensive.
Can you tell us about how much money it costs for a large institution like UC Berkeley or like Harvard?
Berkeley probably spends $30 million a year to get access. Science journals take in about $10 billion in revenue a year. That's on the order of $5,000 per article, even though all the knowledge that those articles contain was generated not by the journal, but by the scientists who send the paper to them. All the actual important work that's done by the journal, I mean, the most important thing they do is get those papers peer-reviewed. That's done by scientists who are being paid by universities as well. So the journals, they're basically being paid $5,000 per paper to lock publicly generated knowledge behind paywalls. They have that monopoly control because scientists give it to them. Because the currency of success in academia is where you publish your papers. And so it's very, very difficult to get scientists to abandon, you know, established high-profile journals in favor of what they should do, which is just post their stuff on the internet for free. We give them monopoly control over the literature, and they do what anybody with monopoly control over something does, which they charge as much as they possibly can to a captive audience.
You began several open source journals, including what was for several years the largest scientific journal in the world, PLOS One.
Yep.
But this has been an entrenched system for decades, right? So how did you kind of approach changing it?
In 1995, 1996, you saw this big movement for science journals to go online. We first became aware of its problems when another big dramatic change in science, which was the growth of the genome sciences, where we were doing experiments on this massive scale where we could study the behavior of every gene in the human genome in one experiment. We went to journals and said, hey, can we have the papers that you now have in an electronic form so we can do this new kind of science? And they all said no. And we all of a sudden realized how ridiculous it was that publishers and not the scientific community actually owned the knowledge we generated. And so we originally thought that it would be as simple as just saying, hey, everybody, this system's really dumb. Let's do something different. But that didn't work. What we arrived at was a model in which, you know, publishers still exist. They take papers, they peer review them, they accept them or reject them from journals. But instead of charging for access to those papers, when you publish a paper in the journal, you just pay a fee to the publisher to cover the publisher's expenses.
The organization's first journal, PLOS Biology, started in 2003 and was an attempt to emulate what Eisen describes as the snooty journals such as Science and Nature, which generate prestige in part by rejecting most papers submitted to them. PLOS Biology became well-regarded and provided a proof of concept for PLOS's pay-up-front, open-access model. The multidisciplinary journal PLOS One, created in 2006, used this same model to become the largest academic publication in the world.
It's now no longer the biggest scientific journal in the world because other people saw how successful we were with this and they've copied the model, which is fantastic. It's not grown as rapidly or as much as we'd like. It's still only maybe 20 or 30% of papers are published in this way. And that's still because of the sort of legacy power of publishers. But I do think things are changing.
And so, like you're saying, journals have sort of become a proxy for the quality of a researcher and their research. And so that was sort of the catch-22 that was at the heart of
it still is.
Efforts to change, right?
Yeah.
That everybody wants to publish in a prestigious journal because it shows that they're a good researcher.
Yeah.
But the fact that everybody wants to publish in these journals means that overall research is a lower quality, right? Because they're looking for big results. They're looking for flashy
things.
Yeah,
so there's another problem. Forget about how journals are paid for and whether their contents are freely available. It encourages people to do work that will be perceived as sexy and important when it's conducted. Often the most exciting results are the most fragile results. So they're the ones that need the most validation and repetition. And but if the only thing that matters is you got your paper into Nature, and it doesn't matter if 6 months from now everybody thinks that it's false, then you have no incentive to do the kind of work that's necessary to prove that something's important. So those people are penalized in the system because they don't get their work into high-profile journals, and they don't get grants, they don't get students. It's a terrible, terrible system. And it's perpetuated primarily by the institutions who should know better, by universities and funding agencies, who are the ones who give people jobs and tenure and grants based on their publications. And what's more, there's abundant evidence that this system doesn't even do what it's trying to do. It's not very good at picking out the best science. I mean, many of the most important things that were, the most important discoveries in science were not published in high-profile journals. And most of the stuff that's published in high-profile journals is forgotten in a year or two. It's not significant. The presence in these journals is not an indicator of importance. It's not an indicator of quality. It's not an indicator of durability. If anything, it's actually kind of inversely correlated. And yet, we still use it.
And there's been sort of a crisis in a lot of scientific fields in the past few years where a lot of the seminal studies are not able to be reproduced.
I think to some extent this reproducibility crisis is a bit overblown. The problem is not that sort of science is dysfunctional and that most research that people do isn't reproducible. It's particularly the stuff that's published in these high-profile journals. This system in which it sort of encourages people to get a flashy result, very rarely do they get results that actually transfer from whatever particular system they're studying to the things we really care about. So they might have made an observation that's valid in a very, very narrow set of circumstances, but it doesn't translate into being important and meaningful. And so the real crisis is that the stuff that gets the most attention and the most money and the most sort of rewards for the people who do it is precisely the stuff that is least likely to replicate in a meaningful sense, that is, it's least likely to actually turn out to be useful.
And another part of that is that researchers really have no incentive to publish things when they don't produce great results, right?
Absolutely. There's a counter-incentive, right?
So nobody knows if you did this study and it didn't work out.
So the same experiments are done hundreds of times in some cases, and before somebody actually publishes that it didn't work. I mean,
how did the PLOS journals overcome that? Because you are making researchers pay upfront, right? So why would I as a researcher want to pay you to tell the world
that I
didn't find anything?
Yeah, most journals will only publish things that they deem to be new and important to people in their field. PLOS One does not impose that criteria. The only thing we ask is that the work be a legitimate work of science. So we will publish and have published many, many papers that are negative results. And it turns out that actually people do want to publish those things, right? Because it may seem like a negative result when you look from the outside, but from the inside, that's a year of some graduate student's time. And if you did good experiments and you did it well, that's something to be proud of. And it turns out that actually in a world where it isn't a huge pain to get your work published, where you don't have to convince some editor that this is important or it's going to cure cancer or whatever. People are actually happy to publish.
So can you just briefly take me through the process? Like, let's say that I, as an individual, have a breakthrough in my garage. I want to publish this paper.
Yep.
I want to publish it in PLOS. How do I do that? You know, how much does it cost? And how do you ensure quality? So how is it peer reviewed? And
right. So you send the paper to the journal. PLOS One has thousands of editors, so they'll find competent reviewers. And the questions for PLOS One are very simple. Do they explain their methods well? Are the data, you know, clear and present in the paper? You know, is it well enough written, clearly enough written that I can understand what they did? And most importantly, the things that they claim at the end of the paper, that these are the conclusions, do the data support those conclusions?
But so it's a pretty typical peer review process, but
yeah,
you're
but you what's don't, different right. is unlike in other journals, we do not ask the reviewers, is this paper important? They're much better at recognizing flaws in the reasoning or the data in a paper, but the reviewers are just bad at figuring out whether something's important. And so we just take that decision out of their hands and let readers decide whether the papers they're reading are actually interesting and important for themselves. So you were asking about the economics. In PLOS One, there's a publication fee of about $1,500. If you come from countries where research funding is much lower, we either charge a discounted fee or no fee. Authors who don't have, like if you're doing this experiment in your garage, and you come to us and say, I don't have any support for this, we don't charge you for that. Our goal is to try to never stand in the way of, like the finances stand in the way of someone publishing things. But I should also point out, I think $1,500 is too much.
And so even at $1,500, have you noticed that that has led to, or have you seen any sort of major research or, you know, things that are of really high quality coming from individuals or small groups or lesser known institutions versus
these big
institutions?
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, the vast majority of the stuff we publish is not, you know, most science isn't done at Harvard, right? It's done, you know, we've published many things from independent scientists. We've published, you know, stuff from student groups. And it's our goal to not just not put a criteria on importance, but not to decide who's a legitimate scientist. We judge the work.
I spoke with Eisen at a conference in Oakland for DIY scientists known as biohackers, who eschew traditional research institutions, often carrying out experiments in garage labs and sharing their raw findings on the internet in real time.
Biohackers are not trying to build careers by definition. They're not trying to build careers in academia that require Nature papers or any papers. So they're much more likely to just have websites where they share ideas and information. And I think that's the way that it should go.
Right. Set up as long as you get the information.
Yeah, right. Like, you know, this whole infrastructure for peer review and editorial oversight, that all exists to serve universities and granting agencies and other people. It has very little utility to me as a consumer of scientific knowledge. Mostly when I'm looking for something, I Google it and I decide on my own if it's interesting. I don't really care where it was published. And so I actually think if we were doing things right, we would take our cue from biohackers and others who've just basically said the system is dumb. Let's just use the internet for what it's good right. for, which is the rapid and nodeless exchange of information.
Shifting gears a little bit here, you have announced that you are running for Senate yep. in 2018 in California. Why did you decide to run as an independent?
I think everybody should be an independent. I think political parties are bad for the country. People should, you know, form coalitions around ideas. They're so obsessed with success as an institution and not at all concerned with, you know, doing the right thing.
And do you identify with any particular political philosophy, or what are the kinds of issues that you
like know, to focus on? My political philosophy is there are big problems we face. I want to go at those problems without preconceptions of what the right answer is. Like, you know, I think we're so locked into this idea, you know, different parties have, you know, they know in advance pretty much how they're going to respond to every issue, and that just doesn't
right.
work out.
So what major reforms would you put in place?
Yeah, so the biggest one is, you know, we have to deal with our changing climate. My primary objective is to get into Congress and try to change the way we think about this problem, to recognize that, you know, I'm not a climate pessimist, for example. There's so much pessimism. People think the world's all collapsing. We have a big problem, but I really believe that we can solve this problem by the right application of science, technology, engineering, agriculture. If we came at this from the point of view of, all right, this is a real problem, but it's also a real problem to say we should just abandon all the things that have make people like their lives today, right? Figuring out ways to capture carbon out of the atmosphere or to capture it before we put it into the atmosphere in coal. We know how to do some of those things, but they're too expensive. We should be investing heavily in better and more efficient forms of transportation. We should be changing the diet of the population in ways that work. I think the most immediate area for us to think about is agriculture. You know, we have government is heavily in controls our agricultural system by subsidies and all sorts of other things. You know, we basically have a socialist agricultural system in this country, but we do it really, really poorly. So I think we could free up farmers and give them a lot more autonomy in the decisions they make that aren't really forced into things by the government, but we give them incentives to do things that are actually good for the environment.
So you've kind of identified two problems there, right? One is that we have interventions that aren't good,
yeah.
And the other is that we should be investing in, you know, certain technologies and progressing things. Since, you know, you're skeptical of that any peer reviewer can know the significance of something,
yeah.
And we've seen what happens when the government gets involved,
yeah.
You know, in these decisions. So why do you have confidence?
Right.
That,
so
you
know, it's a big challenge. It's a personal challenge I have. Like, you know, I believe in principle that government can do a lot of good things, but almost every time I've interacted with the government, they don't do a good job at what they're doing. So we've structured so many of these programs with ideological objectives and not practical, empirical objectives. I'm a big believer in removing government subsidies from, you know, that tell people, oh, you have to grow this, and try to say to people, well, we need an agricultural system that captures carbon and puts it back into the earth. We will pay you if you figure out ways of doing that. We need to get people
to... So sort of higher level targets.
Yeah, like the best, by far and away the most effective and subversive force we have in our current universe is the free market. We have to let it work on these things. And the one thing the government can do in all these things, it just has a lot of money. And like sometimes you have to spend a lot of money to do kind of far-reaching things. I think it's one thing the government actually has done historically good job in is investing in new technologies.
And how would you like to see the intellectual property regime changed?
We just have to have government-wide policy that if the government's spending money on something, it belongs to the public. And that's the simplest piece of legislation you could ever write. It'd be one paragraph. And more broadly, you know, our patent system is completely broken. It does not incentivize people to develop new ideas. It's become just kind of a game for lawyers. It's just one of those things where people are so afraid of touching it at all that we end up with a system that everybody knows is broken.
What's next for you and the Public Library of Science and just the open access science movement in general?
The next thing for me is to change the way we do peer review. The internet makes it possible for everybody who ever interacts with a work of science to review it. And we should not have a system in which all the important judgments about the value of a work are made at one fixed point in time by two or three people. So what I want to do over the next, you know, several years in publishing is create a system in which everything gets published quickly and freely. What we need is good ways for people to find papers that are relevant to them. And technology can solve that problem way better than journals can. You know, scientists, if we make it easy for them when they're reading something to say, hey, I think this is a great idea, this particular part of this paper, hey, they were really onto something, or they did this really poorly, we should harness the power of the whole scientific community, who are constantly interacting with the literature in different ways, to be the new form of peer review. PLOS was all about doing this from within the journal publishing system, but I think now the journal publishing system should go completely. We're 20 years into the internet and we're still acting as if the internet doesn't exist in the way that scientists publish, and that's just totally nuts.
Well, great, thank you. We've been talking with Michael Eisen. He is a co-founder of the Public Library of Science and a professor of molecular and cell biology at UC Berkeley. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
For Reason, I'm Justin Monticello.